How do you love and care for the beauty of the earth? Nathan asked if a couple of us would just kind of share what we do at our houses and our homes to care for the beauty of the earth. Stacy and I and our family several years ago really got convicted about this idea about how much God loves his creation, every creature and every part of this earth. And we really re-architected the way our home worked. And I have a super long list that I will not go through with you today, but I will tell you a little bit about what we do. In the area of food, we really changed our buying habits and the way we eat and what we eat, because and you've probably heard a lot of this. The way our food is conventionally grown is it's rough on the earth. There's a lot of fertilizer, a lot of pesticides that's put into the ground that absolutely destroys the soil in which our food is grown, to the point where our soil becomes something that holds a plant. It's devoid of nutrients, and you have to keep feeding it because we've ruined that. So, you know, a lot of people buy organic food because organic food is supposed to be better for you, but for us, it's as much a matter of how is the earth taken care of in growing that food. And we also decided that we would take back a portion of that growing process for ourselves. So a lot of you know that we're, at least I'm an avid gardener. I love putting my hands in the earth and growing the food that we eat. And that's a part of that. We want to care for the earth and we want to care for the food and we want to take back and maybe lessen the impact on the earth that conventional farming would damage it. Also, if you've been to our house, you've seen the little bunnies that are at our house, and the bunnies are there because we eat the bunnies. Sorry, that's why they're there. They have names, and we take care of them. But again, the way that meat is prepared, especially in our culture, it's horrific in some circumstances, right? And so, yeah, we have this philosophy, right, that we want our animals to live a great life up until the last day, right? So we try to take care of our animals. We like to know what goes into their bodies, and we like to know, you know, when you look that rabbit in the eye before you slaughter it, you say thank you, and you thank God because he's provided something for you. And you feel that in a way that you don't feel when you go to the store and you pick up a slab of pork, right? It's a much different feeling, and it puts you more in connection with how much God loved that animal and that you have to appreciate that animal and what God has done in providing that for you. So that's just a little something that we do at our house to love and care for the beauty of the earth.
Certainly cannot one-up that, for sure. We do recycle religiously, and Gary is annoyed by that, but it still happens. I go through the trash can and recycle, but anyway. Even though we use some plastic containers, some things we buy at the store in plastic containers that we can't buy any other way, I prefer to buy in glass bottles that can be, less chemicals to leach into our food, but a better reuse of those containers, and we do recycle. We've cut down on the amount of paper towels and other paper products that we use and try to, I wear out my my dish towels, just because I mop up things that I used to mop up with paper towels, but those dish cloths can be laundered. And which brings to mind another thing, I have cut down on petroleum-based products. So I use a laundry detergent that is not petroleum-based. Petroleum is not a renewable resource. And so one of the detergents that is, it's more vegetable-based, actually, but the pH is correct to remove the soil from clothing. And it says on the bottle, if every U.S. household replaced one bottle of petroleum-based detergent with plant-based, 149,000 barrels of oil would be saved each year, enough to heat and cool 85,000 homes. So that's a significant amount. I can't do that all myself, but we all could do that to save that renewable resource. I guess another thing that, and I know this is my own annoyance, is down my street, after they mow the yard, one of our neighbors blows his grass into the street. Now, the water all comes along, and that goes into the river. And so I just think, to me, I know this is my prejudice, and Gary hounds me about this, my prejudice about blowers. Blowers kind of mean I don't want to clean it up. Let me blow it in your space. So that's just my thing on blowers. The recycling thing has been a gradual thing in our house, and then recently when the city gave us those large recycle bins the size of our garbage cans, that made it apparent to us how much we need to recycle. And though we don't put that out every week, probably every 2 weeks, and those items would be going in a landfill somewhere, and so we feel better about that.
This is from Job chapter 12, verses 7 through 10. However, call on the animals to teach you. The birds that sail through the air are not afraid to tell you the truth. Engage the earth in conversation. It's happy to share what it knows. Even the fish of the sea are wise enough to explain it to you. In fact, which part of creation isn't aware? Which doesn't know the Eternal's hand has done this? His hand cradles the life of every creature on the face of the earth. His breath fills the nostrils of humans everywhere.
So we got out of the van, and the first time we'd been in this place, and I'm looking ahead, and it's just this really beautiful, just the scene, everything was really beautiful. And I say something about, you know, what a beautiful place this is, and I turn around, and my wife, she's crying. and I just realized, whoa, I think it's beautiful, but look what it's doing to her. And I envy that, and I knew that I'm dull. I think it's in the nature of love to care for someone. That love is not limited to people. I think we can also love creation. We can love what God loves. For myself, there's been a growing desire to look more closely at creation in order to understand God better. I see this very much as worship leadership. We need other people besides musicians and poets to lead us in worship. We need naturalists, we need ornithologists, we need biologists to open our eyes to creation, open our eyes to the glory of God, the genius of God, the love of God, the provision of God. Everything is created for the sake of something else. So this interconnection that something in creation is actually has its own life, but its own life benefits something around it. As Paul says in Romans, that God's invisible qualities are made manifest by what has been created. Creation doesn't have to be beautiful. It could just be functional. But it is also beautiful, incredibly beautiful. As C.S. Lewis says, when we see something beautiful, we don't just want to see it. We want to go into it. We want it to become part of us. There's a sense of our belonging somehow to beauty. There's a fair translation of the Greek word that we translate perfect when we read Jesus says, "Be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is," that can be translated, "Be ye beautiful as your Father in heaven is beautiful." Most of us sense that we're out of touch with creation. We go for a walk in the woods or go on holidays, and we just know right away, ah, I've been missing this. This is an important part of my humanity.
Well, I have a friend, and when my friend was growing up, he had a pet fish. Actually, it was a kind of shark that was about the size of your hand. And can you guess what the shark's name was? Mr. Sharky. Close. And so my friend's mom told me that when he was growing up, they didn't have a lot of pets, so Mr. Sharky was a very important part of the family. And my friend really loved Mr. Sharky. And so every night, before bed, he would run up to the fish tank, grab the sides of it, kiss it, and say, "Good night, Mr. Sharky, I love you." Well, as with every story that has a good ending, this one doesn't, because my friend was also in charge of feeding Mr. Sharkey, and eventually he forgot, and Mr. Sharkey floated to the top of the fish tank. He died. Isn't it ironic how a being who is so remarkably capable of sweet innocence and of love and of joy can at the same time, whether intentionally or unintentionally, be a being who neglects that which is under his care and instead of life brings suffering and death? Well, a massive study was recently conducted by scientists at the University of Stanford. In fact, it was published this June. And these scientists, based on their conservative estimates, have concluded that our planet is in the midst of a sixth mass extinction. So species extinction is actually a natural phenomenon. It occurs at what scientists call a background rate of about 1 to 5 species a year. That's normal. What's not normal is that since the advent of the industrial age in the 18th century, that rate has increased to an unparalleled 1,000 times the normal background rate. So to put that in perspective for you, it's not 1 to 5 species that are going extinct every year, but on average, it's about 1 species going extinct every 8 hours. And so at that rate, these scientists are calculating that by 2050, 35 years from now, mid-century, 30 to 50% of all biological species will be extinct. Can you guess when the last time a species extinction of this magnitude happened? 65 billion years ago, when an asteroid hit the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs. This is the first time that a mass extinction has been caused by us, by the hands of humans. And on top of species extinction, there's other things to be concerned about. There's serious concern for climate change, rising ocean levels, alarmingly depleted levels of fresh water, deforestation at the rate of 1 acre per second, and our ocean's fish stocks being pushed to their brink. And so as I've looked at this stuff for the past few years and studied this, maybe you're wondering, maybe you're just kind of realizing this for the first time or finding out for the first time, but the question I'm always asking is, and maybe you are too, is, well, what are we supposed to do about this? How are Christians supposed to respond to this? How are we supposed to care for our planet? And how are we supposed to relate to the rest of creation, to the non-human? And so non-human is a term that I'm going to use frequently throughout the sermon, so I'm going to go ahead and define it for you up front. So here it is. Non-human equals everything in creation that's not human. So birds and trees and dirt and plants and mountains and streams, you get the point. Well, the biblical prophets also were aware of the dire effects that humans could have on the ecological order. Much like the Lorax in Dr. Seuss's The Lorax, who says, "I speak for the trees and the brown barbalutes," the biblical prophets also speak for the earth. They give voice to the earth. And if you remember in Hosea chapter 4, Hosea comes to the people, and Yahweh is talking to the people. But Hosea basically says, look, God is bringing a lawsuit against you. He's taking you to court, Israel. Because when he looked out on the land, he saw no truth. There's no truth in the land. There's no knowledge of God in the land. There's no faithfulness. Instead, there is lying and deceit and adultery and murder and bloodshed after bloodshed. And Yahweh says, basically, Israel, you have broken every one of my most basic commands. And so what are the consequences of that? This is what Hosea says. This is the consequence. He says, therefore, the land mourns, and all who are in it languish, along with the wild animals, the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea are perishing. And you know, Hosea is not alone in this. Isaiah has something to say. Amos, Joel, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, They all have something to say about this. In fact, there's this strong in scripture, there's this strong correlation between the health of the land and the people's relationship with God. And if you go to 2 Chronicles chapter 36, the reason that Israel goes into exile, the reason they go into exile, Yahweh says, because you did not practice ethical and sustainable treatment of my land. My land did not get the Sabbath rest that it was supposed to get, and until my land gets its 70 Sabbaths, you will be in exile. But even more than that, I think Hosea's words are pertinent and very relevant for today. So Hosea says, and the land mourns. And what I have on the screen back here, you're seeing a graphic from World Wildlife Federation of Borneo, which is in Indonesia and Southeast Asia. And it's depicting the level of deforestation from 1950 until where scientists predict it will be in 2020. I think the last report came out in about 2010. But as you can see, since 1950, there has been a movement from Borneo being about 75% forest to just 33% in 2020. That's a significant amount of forest. And in this part of the world, Indonesia and Sumatra, these places over there, this is a really important forest ecosystem in the world. It's one of the world's most important. You probably think of like the Amazon, and that's a very important. But this area is one of the most important in the world. And some of the most critically endangered species, these are the species that are basically on life support. Some of the most critically endangered species in the world are located here in this region of the world. And deforestation from human consumption primarily is a cause. And so we've talked about how the animals are perishing and the birds of the air and biological species, even plants and things like that. But Hosea says, and even the fish of the sea are perishing. So how bad is the fish population in the world today? Well, according to World Wildlife Federation, recent United Nations report, Greenpeace, Census for Marine Life, and a host of other sources that I didn't put up there, today 80% of the world's fish stocks or fish populations are depleted. To put that in more technical terms for you, that means that they are fully exploited or overexploited. We are overfishing them to the point where the fish can no longer recover and repopulate their populations. So this happened on a small scale in 1992 in Canada, up in the North Atlantic. There was a large cod fishery there. And people had been fishing in this area for centuries before. But in about the 1950s, this cod fishery really picked up. This business really picked up. And they basically fished and fished and fished until 1992. That fish stock, all that cod, that whole population collapsed. They fished those fish out of existence. And what's crazy about that is not just that how it affected the ecosystem, but get this, more than some 35,000 people lost their jobs because of this. This was a huge industry, a big deal. And they kept fishing and fishing and fishing faster than the fish, and they fished them out. And so guess what? 20 years later, in 2012, with tons of protection for the cod, those fish have not recovered. Their populations are too insignificant, and scientists believe, because of the way the ecosystem has changed, that those fish populations will never be of any significant amount, if they even survive. And so at the current rate of overfishing in the world, and that includes both illegal and legal fishing, by 2050, again, by mid-century, based on the rate, the current rate of overfishing, 100% of the world's fish population or fish stocks will be depleted. That means we will have so much exploited that the fish, that we will overfish them out of existence. The fish will in all the world's oceans will not have the ability to keep up with our demand for fish, and there will be no more fish in the ocean. Now, maybe you're thinking, that's crazy. That could not possibly happen. But here's the deal. It is happening. It's happening right now. And we're already up to 80% of the world's fish stock depleted. We only have 20% to go. And the amount of human consumption and the amount of humans on the planet and their need for consumption more than what's normal is only increasing. And if we think that's going to have a significant, I mean, can you imagine the ocean with, there's no more inspiration for Disney Pixar movies like Finding Nemo or anything like that. Can you imagine the ecosystem, what that will be like, much less how that will affect humans? The consequences of that will be catastrophic. Well, the non-human actually plays a much bigger role in Scripture than we often realize or even acknowledge. You may think of Genesis 1, where the non-human shares in God's creative power. God gives blessing to the non-human, and the non-human does its own thing and reproduces willfully and joyfully, saying yes to God's invitation to life. Or maybe think of the book of Exodus, where God rallies the natural forces of creation. If you remember the plagues, the hail and the flies and the frogs and the darkness, God rallies the obedient forces of nature and sends them like an army against the disobedient human powers of Egypt. And so what's really crazy about this is that in some sense, the non-human plays a significant and vital role in the salvation of Israel, in the salvation of humans. Or maybe you think of Job, where God takes Job out on this magic carpet ride to show him a whole new world, much like Aladdin takes Jasmine on a magic carpet ride, except I think when God comes to you in a whirlwind and asks you question after question, it's probably not quite as romantic. But he takes Job out on this guided tour out over to the Memphis Zoo and then over to the Pink Palace Museum and back to the bison exhibit at Shelley Farms, all to show Job that despite the chaotic suffering in Job's life, God's creation remains good, it remains ordered, and every part plays an integral role in God's creation, even those parts of creation that seem untamable to Job or even a bit dangerous to Job. God delights in all of it, and it all has its part to play. It's as if God is saying to him, Job, human, open your eyes. You are but part of a larger created order, a created order which is good, and which I care for, and which I am sovereign over. Or maybe you think of Jonah, where God is trying to get the attention of his disobedient prophet. And so in order to get his attention, he calls on the non-human. And it says he appoints, like a king might appoint someone. He appoints all these non-human entities, the storm, the big fish, the plant, the worm, the scorching east wind and the sun, all to get Jonah's attention so that God can save both the human and the animal inhabitants of Nineveh. Isn't this what the psalmist says in Psalm 36:6? You save human and animal alike, O Yahweh. Well, my story about Mr. Sharkey actually does have a better ending. I won't leave you hanging with a dead fish. Because when my friend grew up, when that little boy grew up, he came to know a being who far surpassed his own ability to nurture and to love and to provide for that which was under his care. In biblical texts like Psalm 104, rekindled his imagination and taught him that all life, all of created order, even as insignificant and as small as Mr. Sharkey, was but part of a larger world community that was cared for deeply by its creator. And I really do, we read Psalm 104 earlier, at least the first half of it. I really think that Psalm 104 is one of the most beautiful and important texts for thinking theologically and practically about the non-human. Because what the psalmist sees in the non-human world creates this strong, heart-opening influence upon him. And so I want to finish up reading the rest of Psalm 104. And I'm going to be reading from the Voice, which I assume most of you do not have. So it'll sound a little different. You can follow along with yours, or you can just listen. The forests are yours, Eternal One. Stout hardwoods, watered deeply and swollen with sap, like the great cedars of Lebanon that you planted, and where many birds nest, and there are fir trees for storks and high hills for wild goats. and stony cliffs for rock badgers, and each place, for each place a resident, and for each resident a home. And the mood, she strides across the night sky, marking out the seasons as she goes. And the sun, he hides at his appointed time. But with the darkness you bring, so comes night. When the prowling animals of the forest are moving about, it is then that the lions seek the food that you, the true God, give them, roaring after their prey. And at sunrise, they disappear and sleep away the day in their dens. And meanwhile, we take to the fields, us people, and to the shops, and to the roads, and to all the places we work until evening when we rest. There is so much here, O Eternal One, so much that you have made by the wise way in which you create riches and creatures fill the earth. Of course, the sea is vast and stretches like the heavens beyond view, and numberless creatures inhabit her. From the tiny to the great, they swarm beneath her waves, and our ships, they skim across the surface. And look, look, it's Leviathan, the sea monster whom you created. He's playing and frolicking in the ocean. In all of these, they look to you to give them food when the time is right. When you feed, they gather what you supply. And when you open your hand, they are filled with good food. And with you, when you withdraw your presence, they are dismayed. And when you revoke their breath, the life goes out of them, and they become again the dust of the earth from which you formed them at the start. But when you send out your breath, life is created, and the face of the earth is made beautiful and is renewed. May the glorious presence of the Eternal linger among us forever, and may he rejoice in the greatness of his own works, he who rattles the earth with a glance, and he who sets the mountains to smoking with a touch. I will sing to the Eternal all of my life, and I will call my God good as long as I live. May the thoughts of my mind be pleasing to him, for the Eternal has become my happiness. But may those who hate him, who act against him, disappear from the face of this beautiful planet. As for the Eternal, call him good, my soul. Praise the Eternal. So I must confess that I am so unbelievably moved by this psalm. Because not only do I see and do I hear this beauty and this joy, but my heart feels it. Because it's as if we're sitting right there with the psalmist as his eyes move around this panoply of creation. And he sees mountains and streams and lush green forest and jagged mountain rocks where animals move effortlessly across them, where no humans would dare venture. And the moon, she marches across the night sky. And the sun, it's like he's playing hide and seek every day, popping in and popping out. And even lethal Leviathan frolics and plays in the ocean, much like Drew or Susie or Mitchell or even Caleb might play and interact in the nursery. In the psalmist's ears, he hears the young lions roaring for their dinner. And all the while, the birds are up in the trees chirping and bouncing around and doing bird things and dropping bird presents on unsuspecting cars. And they're singing such melodious tunes that you would think they were jamming out on Beale Street, because satisfaction abounds. And the psalmist's heart is filled with wonder and awe at all the beauty and the goodness and the dependence and the life and the delight. All of such a profoundness that the psalmist cannot help but with reverence and with rejoicing to praise Yahweh. Because he sees a beauty in the non-human world, an intrinsic value and a life of its own, apart from any need of humans. And not only that, but God's wisdom and his goodness are evidenced in the things he has made. in all the way these biological creatures and ecosystems interact with one another in their respected ecological zones. That's why whenever a species goes extinct, a species like the northern white rhinoceros, of which there are only four left in the world, whenever a species like that goes extinct, or miles upon miles of Amazonian rainforest or Sumatran rainforest or are deforested, or we overfish the fish out of existence, every time something like that happens, we miss an opportunity to see God's goodness and to see his wisdom and to see his glory. And as the Psalms say, where all creation continually praises God, we also are cutting off a significant part of God's praise. But as I've studied this over the past few years, there's one thing I think I've learned the most. And I think what the psalmist is guiding us towards is that even if we humans are in the center of God's circle of creative and redemptive activity in the world, even if we're in the center of that circle, we are not the circumference of that circle. Paul says in Romans, and maybe this is why Paul says in Romans, the non-human world is not left behind. Just as it was unwillingly subjected to bondage, to decay, and suffering and death because of the failed care of the first Adam, so it is in the new Adam and his new gardeners, his renewed gardeners, that the earth itself has a hope of its own future resurrection and its own eternal nourishment and rest. So if you have eyes, look. And if you have ears, listen. And if you have a heart, open it. Because God is showing us that the new creation that comes for those who are in Christ, it does not end with us, and that's a beautiful thing. And as we are being conformed to the image of Christ, we take on the values of our God, a God who deeply and abidingly and faithfully cares for and nurtures and provides for all of his creation, human and non-human, the entire created world. And so you heard the testimony earlier from David and from Mary, and I thank you guys for sharing that. I really do. And there was another person that I really wanted to share today, and they're not here. So if you get a chance to talk to this person, if you can get them to talk, I encourage you to do so. And that's Mercer Powell. And if you ask Mercer Powell about the beauty of the earth, you'll realize pretty quickly that he has a tender heart for God and his creation. And as my beautiful wife, Stacy, read Job earlier, and Job says, ask the animals, they'll tell you. The plants know, they'll tell you. So I say to you, ask the children, and they will tell you about God's creation. And I think of my own testimony, how every morning at about 4:45, 5 o'clock, who knows what time it is, the sound of comes down the hardwood floor, and into our bedroom comes this boisterous chorus of oinks and grunts as our pig Luau comes into the bedroom, ready to lead us back into the kitchen where he thinks this feast he's been dreaming about all night is. And so one of us gets up and goes down the hallway, kind of like we're in this zombie apocalypse. And we get to the kitchen, and there we're greeted by this big, white, fluffy dog who's wagging his whole backside, and he's panting, and it's like he hasn't seen us in years, even though it's only been a few hours. And you know, that can get kind of annoying at 4:45 or 5 o'clock in the morning. But I think this is where God flipped the switch for me. Because as I looked down at them, and they literally looked up at me, the words of the psalmist now come to mind. Each of these look to you to give them their food when the time is ripe. And it's amazing to me how they are dependent upon Stacy and I in every conceivable way for their life, for their food, for their attention and love that we give them. They depend on us. And I thought about that. If they depend on us that much, how much more do I and do we depend upon our God to provide and to care and to nourish us? And even more that, we have something in common with the non-human. And I realize this because we actually share a lot with them. Some of them were created on the same day as us. At least all the animals, those that have animate, those are animate beings, have the breath of life in them. We were all giving a blessing together. We are all created from the earth. And we all have the same Creator God, the same God who provides for and nourishes and cares and loves for everything He's created. And so I think the challenge for us, I could give you a bunch of practical things to go out and do. And you probably already know a lot of those things, or you're already doing those practical things. But here's the deal. If we don't first start where the psalmist starts, if we don't start in praise, if we don't let the beauty and the diversity and the goodness of God's creation, if we don't let that come into our hearts and let it be written upon our hearts, then over time, all those practical things will fizzle out. So the challenge I leave you with, the challenge for all of us as we start this series, is to let the wonder and the beauty of God's creation, let us do like the psalmist, let it lead us to praise of Yahweh. Let us start there. Because Paul says that the non-human world, its destiny is intertwined with our destiny. And so I think if we start there, I think if we start from praise and from filling our hearts with what the psalmist sees and what the psalmist experiences, I think if we start there, then we can truly appreciate the gospel as good news, but good news that truly spreads to the ends of the earth. And so if you are visiting today, we're really glad you're here. We know we're doing a big barbecue, and we're having a bounce house out in the hot weather and all that stuff. We're really glad you're here. I encourage you, this series for the next 4 weeks is going to be, the class is going to be an important part of that, because we're going to continue the conversation each week from the sermons into the class, where we can dig a little deeper into things and we can discuss things, we can express doubts and fears and disagreements even. So I encourage you to be a part of the class. We're going to be combining adults and teens. And I think that's a good thing for adults and teens to be able to share and to pray together. And prayer is going to be, I've built prayer in as the most vital part of this. Our prayer and our presence with God as we talk to Him about these things will be the game changer for all of this. So we are going to do that in a community.